Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today is an episode of the Weekly Docket where I recap the top headlines in true crime for the week. If you're new here, make sure that you hit that follow or subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening to so that you don't miss any future episodes. It costs you nothing, but it does help me out a little bit, so make sure you do that and then you don't miss any future episodes. All right, now we've got a lot to cover this week. There's been a lot of stuff that has gone on, especially on social media, and I've had some people request stories, and so we're just gonna get right into it. A joy-filled weekend turned into a scene of unimaginable tragedy when a Utah mother shot her 11-year-old daughter inside of a Las Vegas hotel room and then turned the gun on herself. The incident, which authorities are treating as a murder-suicide, occurred on Sunday, February 16th at the Rio Hotel and Casino. The victims were identified as Tanya McGeehan, who was either 34 or 38. I've seen different reports that differ slightly on her age, and her daughter, Adeline, who went by Addie, Smith, who was just 11 years old. Both were residents of Utah and had traveled to Las Vegas to participate in a cheerleading competition with their gym, Utah Extreme Cheer, or UXC. Addie was a young cheerleader with dreams and enthusiasm for her sport. She loved to cheer. She loved gymnastics. Like, the members of the cheer community, they all described her as beloved and energetic and a child who worked hard to earn her spot on a competitive team. So this was something she was clearly passionate about. Las Vegas Metropolitan Police say that on Sunday morning, cheer team members became concerned when Addie and her mom failed to show up for a scheduled meeting with the team. Now, according to police, the team officials attempted to make contact with Tanya and Addie, and when that failed, they requested a welfare check at their hotel room. So officers and hotel security initially went and knocked on the door, and they called into the room, but they didn't get any answer. So with no immediate signs of foul play or danger, police cleared the scene. It was not until later that afternoon, when hotel security received additional requests for a welfare check, that entry was finally made into the hotel room. At around 2:30 p.m. local time, security and investigators opened the door and found Tanya and Addie inside. Both Tanya and Addie were gone from gunshot wounds. They were pronounced dead at the scene. Investigators with the Las Vegas Police Homicide Division determined that the mother shot her daughter and then shot herself based on evidence inside the room and statements from police officials. And there was reportedly a note that was left behind on a nightstand as well. While Las Vegas police have not released a motive, local court records from Utah suggest a long and bitter custody battle between Tanya McGeehan and Addie's father, which had dominated their family's history for years. Court documents obtained by various news outlets indicate that a divorce in the late 2010s, followed by multiple custody adjustments through 2024, include a period where Tanya was restricted to supervised visitation due to concerns over parental alienation and domestic violence issues that were observed in court filings. The allegations that the dad was making against Tanya were that, you know, she was unstable, that she was violent at times, and basically needed that supervised visitation. The custody orders included specific pickup plans, either at school, but only if the cars were parked 5 parking spaces apart, or at local police stations. And then strict exchange requirements were put in place to minimize any kind of direct conflict between the parents, which honestly is just so insane to me that, you know, things can get that toxic between parents that they are required by law to park 5 spaces apart, but you share a child together. Like, what does that do to this poor child's mental health? I can't imagine. But in May of 2024, new court orders reinstated joint custody with alternating weekly schedules. So they were like week on, week off. And there were detailed parameters for how exchanges should take place. I guess they were, you know, required to not record the exchanges. But McGeehan's ex-husband was later the one to request the welfare check that led to the discovery of the deaths. So I think the parents of the cheer team, or, you know, maybe the coaches, were contacting Addie's dad to see if maybe he knew where Tanya might be or where Addie might be, even though I don't think that they were in Vegas at the time. But regardless, the ex-husband is the one who requested that second follow-up welfare check that led to the ultimate discovery. Then more information came out via the New York Post. Tanya's mom, Connie, said that her daughter, obviously being Tanya, had some ongoing issues with some of the moms on the cheer team. Connie said, quote, "There's one or two ladies that she never got along with, and it got really bad a month ago. In the last competition, another girl was dropped, and some of the moms were blaming Addie. They were sending Tanya mean messages. Cheer was her and Addie's life. I think something happened the day before that made her spiral," end quote. And a source that is reportedly close to UXC confirmed a recent confrontation between Tanya and another mom in the team's waiting room. Connie said Tanya and Addie had been living with her in her 7-bedroom Salt Lake City home, as well as with some other family members. And she remembers Addie as loving gymnastics. She loved her friends. She always seemed happy no matter what. And, you know, Connie said Tanya seemed like she was in a good mood when they left for the competition. She had made gifts for the cheer team. She had bought new clothes for the trip and was posting pictures of Addie doing backflips. But Connie noted that one of the photos Tanya posted of Tanya and Addie together looked off. She said there was something that just looked off about the picture, and it clued her in that something was wrong. She just didn't know what at the time. Now, Las Vegas police homicide detectives have labeled the incident a murder-suicide based on preliminary investigations. Like I said, a note was reportedly found at the scene, so who knows, if it adds more context, but authorities have not publicly revealed its contents. When it comes to cases like this and there's allegations of parental alienation, I feel like maybe I have a unique perspective just because I have had to share custody with my two oldest children, and, you know, it has been contentious at times. And so I do understand and have empathy for situations that turn sour. However, I also realize that the system can be villainized in a way that if you accuse a parent of parental alienation, one, how do you really prove that? But two, I mean, I know that there are ways to prove that, but how was this dad proving it would be my question, because Tanya was posting on her Instagram screenshots as I think it was as late as like 2018, 2019, 2020, that, you know, showed these text messages that the dad was sending Tanya, calling her, and excuse my language, this is going to be really hard to hear, but calling her a retarded cunt, and things of that nature, calling her fat and stupid, just like the R word, C word combo was just like really appalling. And so, you know, who's to say that the dad didn't have money that he was using, you know, because obviously Tanya's living at her mom's house. She probably doesn't have a lot of money to fight a court system, especially like a child custody situation. I mean, I've seen people spend tens of thousands of dollars on attorneys and, you know, court fees just to get nowhere when it comes to child custody agreements. Now, please don't misunderstand me. The fact that she took her daughter's life before she took her own life is cowardly and sick and just so tragic. I mean, I will never understand a parent being able to hurt their own child in that way. If you're suicidal, then, you know, deal with that or take yourself out, but don't take other people with you. Don't just leave a wake of collateral damage and destruction if that's what you ultimately decide to do. The whole situation is just tragic. I don't think that anyone, you know, me, you, nobody except the family knows really the depths of what happened between these two, but it is sad and it really is eye-opening to how contentious these like custody battles can get. And I really hate that for this family. And then in somewhat of a similar case of a parent murdering their child, on Monday, February 16th, a routine youth hockey game at the Dennis M. Lynch Arena in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, turned into a scene of horror when a man opened fire in the stands, killing members of his own family and injuring others before he ultimately took his own life. The suspect has been identified by authorities as Robert Dorgan, 56 years old, also known publicly by names including Roberta Dorgano or Dorgiano and Roberta Esposito. Now, apparently he struggled with some identity issues, but he opened fire on four members of his family and friends, a family friend who was attending the game to watch Robert's son play. Now, the deceased victims were identified as Robert's ex-wife, Rhonda Dorgan, and his son, Aiden Dorgan, a son that they shared together. The three injured victims were identified as Rhonda's parents, Gerald and Linda, and Thomas Garuso, a family friend and assistant principal at Charles E. Shea High School. As of the latest reports, all three remain in critical condition. Now, the shooting occurred around 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time during a boys' high school hockey game between Coventry Johnston and Blackstone Valley teams. The arena was full with families, teammates, and spectators when Robert approached his family members in the bleachers and opened fire. Police confirmed that Robert had two firearms on him, a Glock 10mm and a Sig Sauer P226, and that at least three bystanders intervened during the attack, briefly stopping him before he was able to pull out a second weapon from his jacket and commit suicide. In the 24 hours before the attack, there were screenshots taken from X that show a post attributed to Robert Dorgan responding to online comments about transgender issues with the phrase, "Keep bashing us, but do not wonder why we go berserk," in all caps. Now, in early 2020, Robert went to the North Providence Police Department and reported that he had recently undergone gender reassignment surgery and that his father-in-law wanted him out of their North Providence home because of it. He told police that his father-in-law threatened to have him murdered by an Asian street gang if he did not move out of the residence. The father-in-law was charged with intimidation of witnesses and victims of crimes and obstruction of the judicial system. Prosecutors later dismissed the charges. And it was this same year that his wife filed for divorce. Under the grounds for divorce, Rhonda initially wrote, quote, gender reassignment surgery, narcissistic personality disorder traits, and then crossed those out and replaced it with irreconcilable differences, which have caused the immediate breakdown of the marriage. Now, Robert has also had conflict with his own mother, reportedly. Again, in 2020, he accused his mother of assaulting him and acting in a violent, threatening manner. She was charged with simple assault and battery and disorderly conduct, and that case was also a point of contention with the father-in-law. Robert told police that his father-in-law threatened to have him killed if he didn't drop the charges against his mother. The case against his mother was ultimately dismissed as well. I think I actually saw reports where Robert moved to Florida and chose not to continue pursuing those charges, and so that's why it was dismissed. But who knows? I mean, that was just something I read. But one of Robert's daughters, Amanda, was in the stands with her two young sons when the shots rang out. Now, Amanda has been pretty vocal about her father's long-term struggles and the threat that she felt during the attack. Regarding the motive, she said, quote, "I just want to make sure people understand this was one person's vendetta against their family. We were targeted. This was very specific. It wasn't random," end quote. On the shooting itself, she said, quote, "I was sitting on the bottom bench with my son, and when I initially turned around, I witnessed him shooting my brother, and then I ducked for cover on top of my son's. I was really in fear for my son's lives," end quote. She also thanked the Good Samaritan who incapacitated her father, saying, "I really feared that my sons were next. I can't thank him enough. I'm certain my sons and I are alive because of him." The Good Samaritan that intervened was able to incapacitate Robert and then, I guess, sustained a hand injury in the process of that. And so he required 9 stitches to his hand, but obviously did not know that Robert had a second gun in his jacket, which is what he was able to pull out to take his own life. Now, in regards to her dad's health, she said, quote, "His whole adulthood, he has struggled with mental health issues. I think his gender identity issues are a symptom of a deeper issue," end quote. Now, on the topic of his mental health and identity issues, I wanted to include a little more context to Robert's background because I think it's important and just kind of provides you with an overall picture that this was not just an isolated event, nor was it something that just spawned in, you know, recent months. So when Robert was a younger adult, he enlisted in the Marines, but he was separated from the service less than 3 months in. And a Marine Corps spokesman, Major Jacoby Getty, stated that the rapid discharge indicated the character of Robert's service was incongruent with the Marine Corps expectations and standards, but declined to provide any kind of specific details regarding the nature of what happened. His daughter says, quote, "He was ostracized from the family because he had a long history of violence and abuse. When somebody doesn't want to get help, they won't," end quote. Now, Robert's other daughter, Ava, who was not at the arena that day, but also had an estranged relationship with her biological father, said, quote, "We were not close in the last few years. I just want them to know that it was my mom and my brother and my dad. That's all," end quote. Obviously, this story is tragic. Obviously, it is rooted in mental health, just as I believe the first story is as well. People who have healthy mental states don't commit crimes like this, especially against their own families. So it would be ignorant to say that these people weren't struggling with some sort of mental health issues. But I'll wrap up this story with this. Rhonda was a mother of three who lived in North Providence and was known for her infectious laugh and her constant support of her children. She was a longtime public servant working for the state of Rhode Island for over a decade, and most recently, she was a clinical lab scientist and a valued member of the pathology lab team at Mass General in Brigham. Now, Aiden was their oldest son, and at only 23 years old, he was known as a great kid who loved cracking jokes. He was a high-achieving student and athlete at the North Providence High School, where he served as captain of the varsity hockey and lacrosse teams. He graduated from Merrimack College last year with a degree in mechanical engineering. While there, he made both the dean's list and the president's list and was known for a senior project where he designed a robot that handed out Halloween candy. Just months before his death, he had started his professional dream job as an engineer at General Dynamics Electric Boat. And this past August, he had asked his girlfriend to marry him, and she said yes. So literally, he was on the cusp of, you know, starting his entire life. He had his whole life set out in front of him, and his demented dad stole it from him. Every January, I tell myself the same thing. This is the year I'm going to feel better, more energy, clearer focus, just less dragging myself through every day. And I'll be honest, I usually start the year doing everything right, or at least I think I am. Like, I'm sleeping, I'm eating better, I'm moving my body, and somehow I still feel exhausted and foggy and irritable over things that normally should not get to me, like even just my kids being kids. Well, for a long time, I just assumed that that was stress or burnout or just life in general. And what I didn't realize is that low iron can show up really quietly. Things like persistent fatigue, brain fog, headaches that don't go fully away, brittle nails, hair breakage, stuff that's easy to brush off or normalize. These are all symptoms that I was dealing with because I was suffering from low iron. And here's the thing, iron deficiency can exist even before anemia actually develops. So you can feel off long before anything looks serious or shows up like on a blood panel. So that is why I started looking into Siderol from PharmaNutra. Siderol is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomal technology. So basically, the iron is protected so your body can absorb it more efficiently, about 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And without the common stomach issues that people associate with iron supplements like nausea or constipation. It's made with just 2 main ingredients. There's 30 milligrams of sucrosomal iron and vitamin C, and it's a simple once-a-day capsule that you can take anytime with or without food. So what stood out to me is that it's backed by over 20 years of research and more than 150 clinical studies, and it's already trusted by over 2 million people worldwide. So if you're starting the year feeling kind of tired or foggy despite having these otherwise good habits, you're not alone, and this might be the support that your body needs. So do yourself a favor and head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Siderol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com with the promo code MAMA. Feeling off doesn't always mean something's wrong. Sometimes it just means something is missing. So check it out today.
It's cozy season, and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit MinkyCouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.
This next case comes out of Tip City, Ohio, where a small, tight-knit community of North Dayton has been rocked by a bizarre burglary-turned-murder situation, apparently. Now, there's not a ton of information out about this yet, but I will continue to follow this because I know that a lot of people are making assumptions about it, and nothing has really been confirmed. I'll just tell you the story. You can decide for yourself. Ashley Flynn was 37 years old. She was a substitute teacher for Tip City Schools. She coached seventh grade volleyball at Tippecanoe Middle School and also taught at LifeWise Academy, which is a local nonprofit Christian education program. From what I understand, the LifeWise Academy kind of integrates their program with the public school system. So I don't know if it's so that people who, you know, have families that are religious but maybe can't afford or don't have access to private education through like a religious school, whether it's a Christian or Catholic school, maybe that gives their families the option to experience LifeWise. But regardless, it's a Christian education program, and she worked for them. She was known in the community as someone deeply involved with children, both in the classroom and on the volleyball court. She was married to Caleb Flynn, and she was the mother of two young daughters. Neighbors described her as warm, friendly, and active in the community. In fact, within hours of her death, ribbons began appearing all around Tip City in the colors pink and purple in tribute to Ashley. So what happened? Well, according to the Tip City Police Department, officers were dispatched at 2:31 a.m. on Monday, February 16th, to a home on Cunningham Court after receiving a report of a burglary in progress. When officers arrived, they found Ashley inside the home with multiple gunshot wounds. She was pronounced dead at the scene. Her husband and two daughters were inside the home at the time. They were physically unharmed. This is the point where I think people's alarm bells start going off, because when you have one person that is shot multiple times and the rest of the family unharmed, it just makes people ask questions, understandably so. But obviously, we have to wait for more information to come out, because this is not, our job is not really to solve these crimes. Our job is just to talk about them, I guess. But her husband and two daughters, like I said, unharmed. Now, police scanner audio later obtained by WHIO indicates that the garage door was reportedly left open. However, I have also seen reports where there was a sign of forced entry. So it could have been that the garage door that you pull your car through was left open, but that the door to go inside the home from the garage was maybe busted open. That's my guess. But a caller stated that someone had broken into the home. We don't know who the caller was. Dispatch referenced a female who appeared to have been shot in the head, and children were inside, but they were locked in their rooms. The full 911 call has not been publicly released, as it remains part of an active investigation. Tip City Police have described the case as a homicide connected to a reported burglary. Again, officers have stated there were signs of forced entry, though investigators have not released detailed forensic specifics publicly. Multiple agencies are assisting in the investigation, including the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, so BCI, Miami County Sheriff's Office, the Miami County Prosecutor's Office, and the FBI has also since gotten involved in this case. I think, honestly, if the Nancy Guthrie case has taught us anything, it's that what we are exposed to as observers of true crime isn't always going to be the full picture. And what we might assume, you know, what might seem like Occam's razor, the most simple explanation tends to be true, sometimes really isn't. And so I don't want to jump to conclusions that the husband is responsible for this, but I know that's where a lot of people's heads are at. And I just want to wait a little bit until we get a little more information before we start accusing innocent people of something they didn't do. All right. Now, this next case was recommended to me through my website, mamamystery.com. That's mamamystery.com. If you want to recommend a story or just put something on my radar, you can do it through my website. And this comes from the heart of Southwest Missouri, where entertainers and family attractions are a major part of the local culture in good old Branson. The defendants in this case are Gary Carson and Janine Carson. They are a married couple known locally as magicians and entertainers based in Branson. If you've never been to Branson, it's kind of like a Midwest Vegas, but without the casinos. Like, it's got the corny attractions like you might see in Vegas, but it's also got a lake and hills. Like, it's got similarities to Vegas, but very different at the same time. It's like a hillbilly Vegas. And listen, that's no shade to Branson. We go to Branson every year, and you know, it is what it is. There's a lot to do down in Branson and a lot to see. If you know, you know. All right. Now, according to federal court documents, both Gary and Janine have been indicted on charges related to the sexual exploitation of a minor, which is a obviously serious and rare charge that carries significant potential penalties because this is a federal charge. Just last month, a federal grand jury sitting in the Western District of Missouri returned an indictment charging both Gary and Janine Carson with the sexual exploitation of a child. According to the indictment, the couple is accused of coercing a minor to perform sexually explicit acts for the purpose of producing photographic and video content. The alleged conduct spanned from January of 2023 through June of 2025. The Southwest Missouri Cyber Crimes Task Force seized multiple electronic devices in June of 2025, which reportedly contained approximately 46 videos involving this identified minor. The charges are federal, like I said, meaning this is a case that is brought by the US DOJ, Department of Justice, not a state prosecutor. Federal exploitation charges are among the most serious in the criminal legal system and can carry decades in prison if convicted. Both Gary and Janine have both pleaded not guilty to the charges. The couple surrendered to authorities after the indictment was unsealed, and according to local reporting from KY3 News, they turned themselves in to face the federal charges. So now a jury trial is scheduled to begin on August 10th of this year in the Western District Court of Missouri. The videos and photos that were seized by the Cyber Crimes Task Force were described as being stored across multiple devices, suggesting systematic collection and possible distribution, although distribution charges have not been specifically publicized in the brief reports that have been made available. Now, child exploitation investigators commonly collaborate across local, state, and federal lines, especially when crimes involve crossing state boundaries or using online platforms. Now, Branson is really close to the Missouri and Arkansas border, so my guess is that it became a federal crime because of the use of computers, but also possibly because of the proximity to Arkansas. If this crossed over state lines, then that would make it a federal case. Branson, of course, is a city whose economy and identity are tied to tourism and family entertainment. So a case that involves performers accused of exploiting a child stands in pretty stark contrast to their public image, right? Now, at this time, there has been no widely published local statement from the magicians' performance venues, Branson tourism officials, or local entertainment organizations. But I guess we'll see how this plays out in the court systems. I would hope that this marks the end of their magician entertainer careers. Next, a case that began with a missing person report has now escalated into an international manhunt involving local police, federal agencies, and law enforcement partners across the globe, all searching for a Navy reservist accused of killing his wife and then fleeing the country. The victim has been identified as Lena Guerra Echevarria, who is 39 years old. She is from Norfolk, Virginia, and according to police and her family, Lena was a devoted wife, daughter, and sister known for her empathy, her kindness, and her strong family bonds. The suspect and person of interest in this case is David Varela, 38 years old, like I said, a U.S. Navy reservist on active duty and reportedly working as an electrician while he was assigned to a naval unit. January 16th was the last confirmed contact that Lena's family had with her, according to court records. Her relatives, many of whom live in Colombia, noted that it was unusual for her not to communicate with her family regularly. On February 2nd, Lena's family reported her missing to the Norfolk Police Department after not hearing from her for more than 2 weeks. 3 days later, Norfolk investigators executed a search warrant at the couple's apartment in downtown Norfolk. Inside, they found Lena's body inside of the kitchen freezer. Evidence from the scene led to initial charges, and on February 10th, an autopsy was performed and completed, and the death was officially ruled as a homicide. Following the discovery, police charged David Varela with first-degree murder and concealing a dead body, a charge tied to hiding the victim's remains in the freezer, obviously. Now, authorities believe David flew to Hong Kong on or about February 5th, just after his wife was reported missing and the police search was underway. So he really waited until people started, you know, digging around to flee. But law enforcement agencies working together included the Norfolk Police Department, the FBI, the Homeland Security Investigations Division, Naval Criminal Investigation Services, and Interpol, which has been engaged to help track Varela globally. Officials believe that he has no known ties to Hong Kong or China, which makes the search much more difficult and complex. It is also significant because the U.S.-Hong Kong extradition treaty has been suspended since 2020, potentially complicating efforts to bring him back to face those charges. Emergency disclosure requests to WhatsApp reportedly produced some location data that pinged in Hong Kong, which provided investigators with a probable route. However, authorities stressed that tracking someone internationally is difficult and ongoing. And considering how long it's taken to find Nancy Guthrie, I don't know that this guy is going to be found anytime soon. I can't even imagine how you would go about tracking someone down that obviously is well-versed in traveling and the military and the U.S. Navy Reserve. I mean, I would imagine somebody who has that type of intel can probably try to avoid authority better than just a regular layperson. David Varela enlisted in the U.S. Navy Reserve in 2007, and reports note that he served multiple states and had more than a decade of service before the current allegations surfaced. Prosecutors say that while Lena's body was hidden in a freezer, he stopped communicating and did not answer calls from his chain of command, which is unusual behavior according to military supervisors. Family members in Colombia told local media that during the weeks that Lena was missing, Varela claimed she had been arrested and jailed for shoplifting, even sending a photo that appeared to show Lena in a prison jumpsuit, which was a claim that has no record in any official arrest database, so I think he was probably using AI to create that picture. But Lena's sister-in-law, Paola Ramirez, provided insight into the dynamics that she witnessed, saying that Varela had exhibited controlling and jealous behavior, restricting Lena's ability to work, study, have friends, or go out alone. Ramirez also alleged that there had been prior instances of violence by Varela toward Lena, though such details have not been confirmed in public court filings. The Norfolk Commonwealth's attorney, Rahman Fatehi, I'm probably mispronouncing that and I'm very sorry, but he says he is seeking to extradite Varela back to the United States to face his charges and that investigators are leveraging international law enforcement tools through Interpol to locate him. This last story I'm bringing you has gripped both the sports world and local Tennessee communities. A former professional football player who was once celebrated for his athletic achievements now faces some of the most serious criminal charges possible, accused of killing his girlfriend in their home. The victim has been publicly identified as Gabriela Perpetuo, who was 25 years old and was discovered dead inside of a residence in Ottawa, Tennessee on Thursday, February 5th. The suspect is Darren Lee, who is 28 years old, a former NFL linebacker who played at Ohio State University before being drafted in the first round, 20th overall, by the New York Jets in 2016. He later played for the Kansas City Chiefs, earning a Super Bowl ring in 2019, and then he had short stints with the Buffalo Bills and the Las Vegas Raiders before his professional career ended around 2021. His career was marked by athletic promise and professional success, but in recent years, his name has only been tied to legal trouble, including past domestic violence arrests and probation. Deputies with the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office were called to a home on Snow Cone Way in Ottawa around 1:30 p.m. on February 5th after receiving a report that someone was performing CPR on an unconscious person inside the residence. When first responders arrived, they found Gabriella unresponsive and later determined that she had died from injuries that investigators believe were inflicted during an assault. According to an affidavit obtained by multiple news outlets, there were no clear signs of forced entry into the home. There was broken glass and blood evidence that appeared in multiple areas of the residence. Blood was found inside the case of Lee's cell phone, suggesting a struggle occurred. Cleaning supplies were found in locations that investigators described as consistent with an attempted cleanup of a violent scene. A firearm, alcohol, and narcotics were also documented at the scene. And at Lee's initial arrest, deputies noted that he had injuries consistent with physical struggle, including trauma to his face, hands, and chest. Obviously, we know those are defensive wounds. Police have described Perpetuo's injuries as extremely severe. She had a broken neck, multiple stab wounds, a human bite mark on one of her legs, severe bruising to her head, eyes, arms, and torso. Detectives told reporters that the home contained blood in several rooms and drag marks on the floors, indicating forceful and violent activity took place in that home. Lee was taken into custody at the scene by Hamilton County deputies, and he was promptly booked into the Hamilton County jail and charged with first-degree murder and tampering with evidence. Officials said additional charges, including possible weapon or substance-related counts, could be forthcoming as the investigation continues. Now, he claims that he found Gabriella unconscious on the couch and believed that she may have fallen in the shower. What a fucking idiot. Like, you really expect anyone to believe that someone breaks their neck, ends up with a bite mark on their leg, has multiple stab wounds and severe bruising to her head, eyes, arms, and torso because she fell in a shower? Like, how dumb must you be? Investigators noted that the physical evidence obviously did not match Lee's explanation. And when you look back at his past charges, it's not difficult to surmise what really happened in that home. Because when you look at his past, his record, it shows that in 2023, he was arrested in Dublin, Ohio on domestic violence charges involving a previous partner. Those charges stem from allegations that he grabbed a woman by the neck and struck her multiple times, among other acts of aggression. He later avoided a felony conviction by pleading guilty to misdemeanor charges, including aggravated assault, and was placed on probation through 2027. As of now, he awaits his next court appearance as the murder case moves through the courts. Prosecutors have not yet released whether they seek the first-degree murder charge with any specific enhancements, like such as a use of a weapon. But the gravity of the charges suggests that they will pursue the case aggressively. No trial date has been publicly announced yet. The investigation remains open, and additional forensic analysis, including autopsy results and toxicology reports, remain and have not yet been released to the public. So we'll see if he ends up pleading guilty or not. If he pleads not guilty, then he's got a pretty tough case in front of him, because I think it's pretty obvious what happened here. But I'll keep you updated on how this moves through the courts. And before we go, I just wanted to update you on a past case of one I just recently covered. It's on the Banfield case. You might remember we just did this episode like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Christine Banfield, 37, was found shot and stabbed inside of her home in Reston, Virginia, along with Joseph Ryan, who was 39 years old. And Brendan, the husband, was a former IRS criminal investigations agent, and they had this live-in au pair or nanny, Juliana Magalhães. And she was only 25 years old. She was having an affair with Brendan in their home. And the two conspired to get rid of Christine because apparently divorce is too expensive or difficult or whatever the case may be. I'll never understand it. But these two conspired to kill Christine, and then they killed Joseph Ryan as collateral damage to make it look like Joseph Ryan was actually the one that killed Christine. ultimately, their whole scheme fell apart. Juliana ended up turning against Brendan Banfield and, you know, basically ratting him out. And she did this for a plea agreement. She pleaded guilty to a downgraded charge of manslaughter for the shooting death of Joseph Ryan, because she admitted that she shot Joseph Ryan, but she kind of turned on Brendan in hopes that it would give her a lesser sentence. Now, get this. She was sentenced on February 13th, so literally just last week. And when she originally took that plea agreement, the prosecuting attorneys recommended that she just serve, that her sentence be for time served, because she had already spent so long in jail. And the maximum penalty for this charge was 10 years in prison. But because the prosecuting attorneys were recommending something lesser, she agreed to testify against Brendan. However, it's not always a sure thing that just because prosecuting attorneys recommend a sentence that the judge actually listens. And in this case, you'll remember the judge in this case is the same judge that presided over the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial just a few years ago. It's the same judge. And she imposed the full 10 years in prison. So the judge completely disregarded the prosecution's recommendation because she pointed out that Juliana never seemed to have any actual remorse for the victims in this case, that she didn't show remorse for Christine or for Joseph Ryan, that she never expressed sadness for what happened to them. And so based on her, the way she behaved throughout this entire process, the investigation, the trial, and everything, the judge felt it necessary to sentence her to the max. So now Juliana is serving her 10-year sentence, which is really nothing when you consider the fact that she shot an innocent person in cold blood to make it look like he killed someone else that she knew was going to be murdered. Like, she should have to serve way more time than 10 years. And I think if the judge had been given that opportunity, she would have taken it. But it's just not every day that you see a judge go against a plea agreement's recommendation. So I thought that was interesting. Had to share with you guys. If you guys have any case recommendations or story recommendations, you can send them my way at mamamystery.com. If you want to support the show and get bonus episodes and ad-free episodes, go to patreon.com/mamamystery. For less than a cup of coffee a month, you can support this channel, and I would appreciate it greatly. I appreciate you all just even for sharing, even just for tuning in and listening. Like, that alone, I'm so grateful for. So thank you for being here. Have a great weekend. Stay curious. Stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.
It's cozy season, and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit MinkyCouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.